Okay, let's get started. So very happy to have a discussion now on defining entanglement entropy in quantum theory. And Georgia is going to start us off, and then Will is going to continue.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here, and thanks everyone for coming. I want to make sure that this is a discussion, so feel free to interrupt, ask questions, answer questions, complain, etc. I am going to talk about the issues surrounding defining entanglement entropy in a quantum field theory. Will is going to take it off from there, and we'll mention a little bit more about defining entanglement entropy in quantum gravity, and or in some kinds of gravity. And so those questions will come later. I will focus on QFT alone right now. And there will be plenty of confusing things there to talk about. So I don't think that this audience needs particular motivation to study entanglement entropy at this point. But if you are unmotivated, please let me know and we can address the crisis. But the flip side of the fact that people like talking about entanglement entropy so much is that everyone has their own slightly different way of thinking about it and computing it. And you know, in simple examples, this might not matter. But then once you go to more complicated theories, then different people might start getting different results or different ideologies of how to do this. So I tried to systematize what I believe are some correct results and correct statements about how one defines entanglement entropy in QFT. And this has been written up in this paper with Jennifer Lin. And I will now use this opportunity to impress this view upon you. So the goal is to give a short four-step algorithm to defining entanglement entropy. And in each step, you will see that a choice has to be made. And so, you know, later when you read a paper which uses some notion of entanglement entropy, you can kind of refer back to these four steps and see which choices have been made, and you know, be able to efficiently compare what different authors may be meaning by entanglement entropy. So that's the plan. And as I said, feel free to ask for clarifications. I will try to keep it short and sweet. So let's start. So, and let me know if I need to write in a bigger font. So the first step, when you want to define entanglement entropy in a quantum field theory, is to define the QFT. And so now, if we're completely honest with ourselves, at this point, we might pack up and go home. Because we don't really know completions for, you know, mass interacting theories. And by definition, I mean something very specific. I mean an embedding into a huge but finite dimensional Hilbert space, such that all my operators are matrices. That's a very tall order, and we know how to do it only for some nice theories. But nevertheless, we can proceed essentially because we essentially know how to do this for both for scalar fields, for fermions, and for gauge fields on their own. And so I can formulate a discussion as a question of how to define entanglement entropy for these kinds of fields. And I can sideline the question of, you know, what is the exact Hamiltonian or Lagrangian in this particularized version, which is going to give me something like n equals 4 on the nose.
So I guess that means the Lorentz symmetry is considered as approximate.
Yeah. I do not want to formulate any definition that relies on a particular symmetry. That's right. So, of course, gauge symmetries are different. But I do not want to assume any global symmetry in defining this. That may simplify calculations later, but it's not a crucial aspect of defining.
Yeah. Does that mean you're dealing with actually something like Legend model?
Yeah, in fact, it's more. I'm being more aggressive than that. I'm in fact also thinking that I want to, you know, regularize even the target space. So if my gauge group is something like U1, I want to think of it as really a ZN. So I really want to be able to, at least intuitively, think about absolutely everything as a matrix. Yes?
Are you assuming the Lagrangian in this picture somehow?
I'm working in the Hamiltonian formalism, so I will not really work with a specific theory. I will work with particular states and operator algebras. So I will not need, at this level, to specify, to assume that there is a Lagrangian description.
If these fit in this picture,
that
they're not perturbatively defined.
Yeah, that's a good question. For many CFDs, we do know the field content. You know, for n equals 4, we know that there are some scalars in some representations and some fermions and some gauge fields and there's some gauge group. So for those, for each of those elements, I can tell you how one generally defines the gauge group, how it defines entanglement entropy, or at least the procedure for defining it. And then you can, the real worry is how do you find the right state in terms of these variables. And you know, for that we have to make a jump and we have to go back to thinking about, you know, replica tricks or holography or something like that. But the discussion that I'm going to present is still useful because it's still going to give you the list of choices that need to be made. And you will know the same choices will have to, you know, be distinguished when we talk about entanglement entropy, no matter how we define it later on using fancy continuum CFT techniques. So that's the motivation for doing something so basic like this. Let me ask Steve.
Related. So, you know, certainly one could think about regulating on the lattice, et cetera, but don't we want to take the point of view that there is a Hilbert space and algebra and so on with an action of the Lorentz group, you know, ultimately as the correct mathematical structure?
That is an assumption that I don't need, but of course, certainly
okay.
I will not need it for this,
but of course,
certainly some theories, as we well know,
right,
will have this thing being a property of their low energy description.
Okay. That, so you're not rejecting
it? Of course not. Yeah, I'm just saying I do not need it and I don't want to rely on that.
Yeah, it sounds like if you take the algebraic point of view and so on, you have on that Lorentz symmetry, but then you cannot define entanglement entropy.
That's right. It's an obstacle rather than a... That's right. So I am totally open, and in fact, we definitely do know that, you know, you take some lattice system of spins and, you know, when tune it to a critical point, and we know it's really well described by a CFT. So it clearly has all of these emergent symmetries. But, you know, I'm going to imagine that I'm defining that my description of my definition of entanglement entropy will apply both to the original UV language and, you know, then you can trace it back and see how it would apply downstream. Yes. Okay, good. Excellent. Thanks for asking for clarifications. Right. So this is step zero, and so as I said, I want to think about different kinds of field content, and the best examples. To keep in mind are two. So one is just let's call it Ising spins. So I have a bunch of sites, and on these sites live there's a two-dimensional Hilbert space on each site, and on each site on sites which I will call little v for vertex, and on each site I have operators ZV and XV, which are Pauli matrices, the usual Pauli matrices, sigma Z and sigma X, and products and their linear combinations of these guys at every V give me all the operators in the theory. So I won't talk more about the defining issues here, but I just want to emphasize that this is this set for all V is enough to specify any operator by taking products and sums. And because, you know, later on we'll talk about density matrices, and density matrices will be equally built out of these guys. Okay, and the other example, which is useful for resolving other confusions, is a U1 gauge theory. That lives, and notice that I'm not even specifying any particular dimension, because we can take these V's to be in some grid or on some random lattice or something. At this level, it doesn't matter. Of course, once we ask what's the ground state of a particular theory, it will matter which dimension we're in. But just for listing the operators, it does not matter. And here we typically talk about vector potentials. But I really want to work with compact variables that I will write in analogy to these guys. So I will define variables that live on. You can think of these as links or vertices plus a direction. So this is going to be the compact variable associated to my vector potential. To my gauge field. Sometimes people call this U, sometimes they call it something else, but I just want to use this notation to analogize. And then I will define the conjugate operator as something like this. Roughly, we can think of it like this. So this is something that shifts my potential by epsilon. And so an epsilon I can think of as some very small, but let's say fixed number. So this is the algebra on all possible links that I want to work with. And in a gauge theory, it's typical to assume that there are gauge constraints everywhere. So that means you look at some operator. Call it G at each site. You take a product of over all the links that come out of this site. So take some site V, look at all the links that come out, and take a product of XL. There's some information about orientation built into this, which is not relevant for this. And the point is that we demand that we only work with operators that leave this constraint invariant. So, and that gives the usual gauge invariant algebra, which contains all the operators X and products of these operators Z along closed loops. These are the Wilson lines. Okay, so this is just a lightning review of the operators that we care about in these theories. We can do the same thing for fermions. We can do the same thing for non-abelian gauge groups, if you wish. So pretty much anything up to spin one, I can recast in this form, and that's essentially all I want to say about the kinds of definitions I need for step zero. So you need to choose some regularization in order to define this, and this is the kind of regularized stuff that I want to talk about. Okay? Good. Now comes the fun part. So far I haven't said anything about entanglement or anything. And now I will. So now the goal is to pick a subalgebra of this entire algebra that we have there. So, and for any subalgebra, we will then be able to define a notion of entanglement entropy, or some notion of entropy, maybe we don't want to call it entanglement. So this is extremely broad. So we can do this in momentum space. We can pick up only modes of certain, only operators that correspond to certain low momenta. We can do it in, we can completely remove modes corresponding to one field, but leave another one or something like that. There's many choices. And in principle, you can ask for an entropy associated to any of these choices. the standard thing to do in quantum field theory is to focus on origin V and to look at algebras AV that are supported on V. So meaning that V is some set of vertices or links or whatever we want, and we look at algebras. We look at sets of operators that are supported on V and that cannot be said to be supported on anything smaller. So we want to look at these algebras like this. And for purposes of defining entropy, we need this algebra AV to be star and unital. This means it contains the identity. And this means that if an operator is contained in the algebra, then its conjugate is contained in the algebra. Then it's Hermitian conjugate. If this algebra is not unital, then we just stop talking about this, or at least I will stop talking about this. And if it's not star, then we take the smallest subalgebra of it, the largest subalgebra of it that is star.
So if you count the identity, then what's the sense of it not being supported on anything smaller? I mean, you could always take it put up with identity.
Something
smaller, and then take the rest of it as put up with identity.
No, okay. So I mean, when I say this, of course, every operator is going to look like, you know, the identity on the complement of this times, you know, something on here, right?
Right, but the something could also include identities on subsets of since you're...
Yeah, of course, yes.
So then what's the... what's the restriction, what's the meaning of the restriction that it should not be supported on anything smaller than V?
I just want to say that let's say that I have some region and that I don't have any operators on this chunk here, any non-trivial operators, so I just don't want to, you know, even consider that, those kinds of situations. So it has to have a non-trivial action on every Hilbert space that's contained in this region V.
But the identity...
Yes, so at least some operators in the algebra have to have a non-trivial action. The identity, of course, will not, but some operator in the algebra has to have a non-trivial action. That's a precise statement.
So you mean that not all action can be factorized in this region, within this region of...
What do you mean by factorized?
Like you don't want something that is inside a subregion of this region. It looks to me that a non-trivial action would be an operator that could be factorized within the subregion and its complement of this region.
I'm not sure I understood what you meant. Sorry. Maybe you can draw a picture later and explain to me and now the point, the important point, and now this is the non-trivial bit that has only started to be appreciated in the last several years, I guess, starting from Will among other people, is that there is no unique choice of an algebra that's supported on V and that satisfies these conditions. There are still more choices to be made at this level. And so let's use these two examples to give you a flavor of what can happen. So let's say we have some region V, and let's say we have just spins. So we have a bunch of sites arranged in some way, and some sites, let's say, are here. So let's say we have some situation like this, and And now we look at possible algebras that act on this guy. So, of course, there is always the, in some sense, the most natural thing is what you can call the maximal subalgebra. So you take every single operator that acts on these guys. So you take essentially every xv and zv, or v in capital V, and you build their products and linear combinations, and everything is in the and that is contained here. So that's the natural thing. But of course, now I can do something weirder. Now I can say, let me take everything except, for instance, you know, so I can take XV, but not ZV, let's say. This will give me an algebra which is also supported on V and not on anything smaller, but it's different from this guy, and in general, it will give me a different entanglement entropy, a different notion of entanglement entropy. And so if we have an algebra AV which is strictly smaller than the maximal one, then generically what happens is that we get these things called edge modes. Or more precisely stated, you actually get that this algebra typically has a center, or that the operators that belong to this algebra are, more generally, are block diagonal in some sense.
So you put that at the boundary, but you could have put it anywhere.
Exactly. Yes. Excellent. That's a point I wanted to make next. The choices actually have nothing to do with choices you make at the boundary at this point. You can also remove some operators here, and that will correspond to having, you know, a mode which is no longer an edge mode, which, you know, lives here. And I will describe what I mean by modes in this sense later. But essentially, you will have once you go to, let's say, once you try to compute all of this using a path integral, essentially what will happen is that at every point where you've strayed from maximality, you will end up getting a sort of classical variable instead of a quantum one. So you will end up having to sum over some classical variables which weigh your path integral in some particular way. And when these things happen only on the edges, then we call them edge modes. But in general, they can live anywhere. Yes.
So far, since you didn't specify any, I mean, you don't have the continuum.
Yeah.
We don't really have a well-defined sense of edge.
Oh, that's a great question as well, and that's actually something I'm thinking about right now with Matt Hedrick, because I have better ways of thinking about the correspondence of this kind of stuff with continua. But yeah, essentially what happens is that in the continuum, the only operators you have are sort of smeared over many latticites. But you know, if we say that there is some you know, effective smearing length, then we can say, okay, so we're going to look only at, you know, the edge will be, let's say, here, really, and this is going to be the, you know, smearing length or something like that. So then we can, and either way, we can then start discussing whether we want to remove some operator that's here. And, you know, maybe we don't want to talk about operators that are here. Maybe we want to, you know, have a little padding. But we can certainly still talk about different edge modes. You might just have to draw pictures that are slightly more complicated that take into account this kind of smearing. But certainly, you can choose some of the smeared operators and not all of them that fit into your region.
So in a lot of gauge theory, you're making a choice about the boundary. You cut some links.
Oh,
the links are in the region or out of the region?
Oh, that's a good question. So this is something that is often confusing, and people draw different kinds of diagrams here. When I say V, a V is a collection of objects on which my degrees of freedom live. So there's no notion of V that sort of contains half a link.
So you've chosen some links
in, some links exactly, out. Yes. And then, yeah, that's right. And then if I have, let's say, gauge theory and matter, gauge fields and matter, then I say some links are in, some links are out, some sites are in, some sites are out. That's the only thing I say. And I don't, and you know, if I have a grid like this, let's say with gauge fields and stuff living here, then you know this thing and this thing are not, I do not mean anything. They're not different. They're not different edges or anything. I only care that, you know, all of these guys and all of these sites are in, and that's it. Right. And yeah. So as I was saying, you can make similar choices in a gauge theory. So in a gauge theory, your operators, the gauge invariant operators, are going to be so these X's, the compact electric fields that I wrote over there, and these guys that you can say that live on faces. So they're products of ZLs over faces like this. So they live on this. This is a face, and this is ZL. And again, I just choose some set of ZLs and some set of WFs and some set of XLs. And of course, I have these guys, the Gauss operators. And the crucial bit is that these are all the operators I have in my theory, and I need to choose some subset of them here. In order to talk about entanglement entropy. So this is just talking about choices of algebra right now. I've not gotten to talking about entropy quite yet, but this is the first choice that is sort of germane to discussing entanglement entropy. And I will give more clearer examples later. But basically, the bottom line is that this is a choice of the class of boundary conditions. And by this I mean the following. If I remove, let's say, an operator ZV from here or from anywhere, then this algebra, the resulting algebra, will have a center because this guy here will now commute with absolutely everything else in this subalgebra. The only thing it failed to commute, XV and its products, are now out. I'm keeping this. Okay, keep this, and this is out. Okay, so XV is in the center of the algebra because ZV and anything else that could fail to commute with XV is no longer here. That means that all the operators that I have left here can be written in a block diagonal form, where XV is diagonalized. So that means that every operator is going to look like, so any operator can look like this. And this is why it's important to think about matrices, because I can then draw these pictures very nicely. And so this one block corresponds to XV being plus one, and this one corresponds to XV being minus one. So I get these super selection sectors. And I can think of this value plus and minus one as essentially the value of this edge mode. And then in particular, the important thing is that any density matrix is also going to have this block diagonal form. And when I compute the entanglement entropy, as I will get to next, I can define the entanglement entropy specific just for this region, and then weighted for both regions together. So that's how you get this extra, non-distillable or classical entanglement entropy, that depending on the author. Basically, because there can be some, you can have a mixture of this state and this state in your density matrix. You can have a mixture of these two possible states of the edge mode. Okay, good. So the important thing that has to be said is that choosing different algebras, let me just finish the sentence here. Choosing different algebras will generically give you different everything that you're used to. So if you're used to a specific topological entanglement entropy or a specific conformal anomaly or something that is somehow detected, some universal stuff that is detected by your entanglement entropy, then changing this thing, sometimes called changing the center, will give a different one. And that doesn't mean that anything has been violated. It just means that the correspondence between entanglement entropy universal quantities and the actual central charge it just depends on this. So you have to be very careful about this, because sometimes if you choose the wrong boundary conditions, you will get something that doesn't agree with your, let's say, topological entanglement entropy. Yeah, Don?
I just always wanted to clarify the framework. You started to say we exclude this operator, we've got special selection sectors and block diagonals. You talked about picking an algebra, and you said all we need is for it to be unital and star. But then it looked like maybe you were also restricting certain kinds of algebras. So I'm a little confused. In this context, once you pick an algebra you're happy with, is it always a von Neumann algebra, or are you talking about defining entropies for subalgebras that are in fact not von Neumann?
Oh, well, everything is a type 1 von Neumann algebra, unless I'm very much mistaken. I mean, as in, unless I'm forgetting some part of the definition of a von Neumann algebra, of course, the type 2 and type 3 have subtleties in their definition. The type 1, I thought, were just matrices, which are star and possibly unital.
But it's a direct sum of the type 1.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I mean, fine. Either way, so this A, B, you may call a direct sum of two.
I just wasn't confused. I mean, yeah? There certainly are, if I remember these things properly, there are algebras which are star and unital and are not von Neumann. And I want to understand if those are included
and they're
in their
type
analysis.
One?
Well, if they're not von Neumann, then they're not type anything.
Well, okay, that's fair.
I just wanted to understand the framework in which you're working. Are we really restricting to algebras that are very much like the examples you wrote down, and therefore which, when you pick out these subalgebras, are von Neumann algebras, or are you telling us that there's some way to work in a larger framework where we have algebras that may not be von Neumann, but I can still think of them in terms of matrices and move forward?
Well, I didn't say the word von Neumann, you did. So the question now for the audience is, do we know what's the proper definition of a von Neumann algebra that is not, that goes beyond this? Because I don't. So
some closure properties, I think.
But the Hilbert space here is always finite dimensional, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't know if.
So is it easy to? I just forget
so
the
I
technicalities
think that's
here.
That's what you can get. But
because it's a C-star algebra and it's finite dimensional, it's always a direct sum of matrix algebra.
Exactly. Yes. Which is essentially what I'm working with. Yeah. Like I'm not saying that this has to be a factor, but
you didn't mention the C part. So it was the
conclusion
of the algebra.
Well, the star part is what matters, I think. Right. Is essentially what does the C.
That there are bounded operators and that there's a norm and so forth. So.
Oh, but like that's, okay, sure. But that's, I basically defined the algebra to be an algebra of matrices, of finite dimensional matrices.
That's
and in
that
case,
I just wanted to check is my point.
And then I think you can naturally induce an operator norm as, the largest operator,
sure.
The largest eigenvalue of the, A star A and stuff like that. So I think that you can naturally get the von Neumann property from that. Yes?
I'm still confused about something. So if we take region V to have no sites on the boundary, and we're in the Ising spin case, then it just looks like finite dimensional quantum mechanics. So if you remove one of the operators on one of the inside sites, so you're saying that's some edge mode, even though it's not on the edge. But how do you think about that just from the point of view of quantum mechanics? Is it like a restriction on the states?
Exactly. So basically, that means that every state that I will talk about that no states can have superpositions of this mode inside. You cannot have states which are superpositions of, that mode inside being plus and minus or whatever. So you can only have mixtures of the two. Or, you can have states which are just, which have a definite value of this thing.
Sorry, it's not really that you're restricting states, it's that there's no observable that can distinguish.
Right. So what I want to say is that there is not going to be a density matrix in this subalgebra which describes the kind of state with the superposition. So once you, and I'm going to talk about reduced density matrices next, So if you start with a state which was super, which had these 2 degrees of freedom superimposed, then when you reduce the density matrix to this subalgebra, then you'll just get a mixture. You will not be allowed to have to be left with a superposition. So I'm just so basically listing the algebra, listing the subalgebra like this, gives me the list of all possible density matrices as well that I can talk about. And I'm saying that no state with a superposition can remain pure. It will have a pure density matrix in that situation. Yeah, and that holds, as you say, regardless of whether the deviation from maximality is inside or on the edge.
I see. So you're always thinking of the density matrix as being built from the algebra, so that's why.
Yeah. I mean, the density matrix has to be in your algebra. So yes. So and this is why the algebraic thing is very useful to me because.
Thanks.
Yeah. Good. Right. So, the next step is to choose a state of the entire system. And then to project, down to a reduced density matrix that lives in this subalgebra AV. This is literally just the projection. Of course, the non-trivial bit is to choose the state. You know, if we say we want a ground state of some complicated theory, we mostly won't know how to express its density matrix nicely. The best way to do this is to do a path integral, which I will get back to at the end. But for the sake of this argument, let's just assume that we have rho, and then you can just do this projection. So there is a unique rho v. So this rho v is unique. It's the unique operator in AV such that the trace of O rho v is the same as trace of rho O, and you can call this expectation of O for every O in AV. So this definition is very formal, but it's also very helpful. And in particular, if you use a compact basis like the ones I've written there, then this definition actually technically gives you a constructive definition of rho v, because it turns out that the definition is essentially this. So for all the basis elements of my algebra, this is the definition of rho v. So B is the set is the basis of the algebra as a vector space. So I get B by just taking all the possible products of these guys. And then it turns out that because there's a natural inner product defined using this trace, that I can sort of invert this relation to get this.
Is it minus one outside the expectation bucket? Or inside?
Minus one inside? Oh, no, it's inside. It's inside. I think I can also write it like this, which. So basically, rho v has to have these O primes here to give me the identity here. So then I just change variables and put this back in. So yeah, I think then if you're in a nice state, then it may be that you can take this outside, but I'm not assuming that. Good. So in principle, you can do this always, and sometimes it's actually useful to do this expansion. Like if you're in a topological gauge theory or something like that, then this is actually very nice to orient yourself. In particular, because these guys are always equal to the identity, we're always in states where this is the identity, you can actually show that rho v is also going to be gauge invariant if the original state is, etc., etc. So I will not particularly use this, but it's nice to have it explicitly written. For most practical purposes, we'll be writing it we'll be computing rho v using a path integral. But anyway, so of course, the point is that we have to end up with a state. And the final statement the final choice that needs to be made is to choose a representation. Or a trace. Or a trace function. And then, so then we can define something like trace rho v log rho v. Because the way I've written this here, this rho v is still really acts on the entire Hilbert space. It just has these trailing ones. It's this rho v is just guaranteed to be a product of is something here, product, the identity on all the external things. So, and depending on whether we think of this like as acting on the full Hilbert space or on just the Hilbert space that's contained in V, we get different answers for SV. So we just need to make sure that when we compare entropies, let's say when we change the size of the subregion, we appropriately change or not change the size of the representation, because we will get trailing, you know, constant factors of log times the difference of the representation dimensions, the ratio of the representation dimensions. Right. So if I were to keep this guy here, then my SV would certainly be something plus, you know, log dim of this guy, which is something huge. So because we technically don't know anything that's happening outside my region. So this is important because once you start changing these guys here, and once you start, you know, changing the region and including other things, you will have to change the representation you're talking about. And you just need to make sure that you're not accidentally excluding some, you know, you're not getting different entanglement entropies just because of that. So this is a pedantic point. Like the meat of the definition really holds here, and I guess here. Everything else is you know, bookkeeping that can be understood, but is essentially trivial. Good. So this is the formal part of this. Now, I guess I can still take some time. I don't know when officially I should pass the baton to Will, but I can talk about how all of this manifests itself at the level of path integrals, which is what we care about essentially the most. The situation is as follows. So this guy here, we will get by doing some path integral, and this is a bit notationally heavy, so I apologize. So we have our region V, and we have our outside V bar, and we integrate out fields here, and we put some boundary conditions phi is equal to, you know, our variables phi at time t minus, and you have these external fields psi and psi. So the usual way you define a path integral over these guys here. And now comes the tricky bit. If my density matrix is like this, because my algebra is not maximal, then I will have something that looks like this. So my rho of V is going to look like, and it could have more blocks, and each block I can write as, by the way, tell me if this is a problem to see what I'm writing here. I know the geometry of the room is, so yeah, I can move there if necessary. So let's label the super selection sectors. By k, and so in each sector I can write a properly normalized density matrix rho bar that's appropriate to this boundary condition k. And this guy here is some weight such that the sum over all these guys has to sum to one. So basically, this is saying this is the usual thing that you will have seen written that depending on your choice of the algebra, you will get some centers, or more properly said, you will get some block diagonal structure here, and you will get this guy. By the way, the algebra does not need to have a center, and it still may have to be block diagonal. This is a thing that is, I think, slightly less appreciated. For instance, in an example of which has fermions, I can remove one Majorana fermion from one edge, but keep the other one. And so the remaining Majorana fermion on that edge site will fail to commute with some of the interior things. And yet my density matrix will end up being block diagonal. Essentially, what happens is that if I have that kind of situation, the blocks will be sort of constrained. Like I will not be able to have to get the density matrix, which has everything concentrated here. In that exotic kind of situation, instead of having a center per se, I will have a constraint saying that these two blocks have to be equally superposed, equally mixed. Essentially, the Majorana thing is going to act as a classical random variable. So that can happen. This is just a parenthetical comment, just to get this out.
Is there a situation where you have non even number of Majoranas?
Let's say on each site I have two Majoranas and I remove just one. So I have an odd number, in some sense. Yes.
When you say the Hilbert space is not well defined.
Well, I would not say that it's not well defined. I would say the following. I would say that the Hilbert space is necessarily, well, I would say that the space of density matrices is well defined, and you can write them as some functions of the remaining Majorana operator and the identity. And the only thing is that you're essentially guaranteed that the remaining the states will not be pure. So in that sense, you don't have a Hilbert space, but you have a set of density matrices that you can still work with. So that's why I say that a single Majorana is roughly like a single classical random variable that you've just put in there.
So how are you guaranteed the states are not pure? I mean, what stops you from considering density matrices that only have one block?
Oh, well, if you want to, okay, so the question is, what kind of density matrices can you build? If you have on one site only one of the two possible Majorana generators on one site, and you can sort of convince yourself by construction that the only density matrices you will get will be the ones that are equally mixed on that one site. I can give you the details later if you want.
So in step two, you said first choose a density matrix.
Yes.
Which sounded like I can choose any density matrix I want built out of some Hilbert space.
Yeah.
And then you constructed an operator in the algebra that sort of realized that.
Yeah.
I can see that there are restrictions on row B because there are only certain things in the algebra.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe this is the point about, do you even have the first part of step two in this setting? Maybe this is like Juan's question. Did you have could you freely choose a density matrix on some Hilbert space to start with?
This one?
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. I mean, of course, you want this row to be in this original A, whatever that is. That's right. So that you can do.
I see. So row is constrained to be something that it lives in A as well.
Yeah. So of course you have to have a somehow allowed state.
It's not a general positive linear function along the algebra, or is that equivalent?
It's probably equivalent for the spin system. If I have constraints like gauge invariance or something like that, then I probably don't want to choose a non-gauge invariant one. In an abelian gauge theory, you can consider violating these gauge constraints. I can consider putting in random minus signs here, and that can work. But in a non-abelian theory, I can't even do that. So you have to be careful there. But yeah, in principle, as long as you have your list of constraints, then you're good. Like your gauge constraints. But then, as I say, like there are some interesting algebras where you will get, you know, where you remove all operators that involve one Majorana on the boundary, but not both, but not the other one, and then you will get interesting boundary conditions, which are neither Dirichlet nor Neumann nor anything. I think I call them Majorana boundary conditions in the path integral. Right, so basically what I meant by this and what I was going to write here, by the way, you can see sort of formally that this will give you something that looks like, you know, minus some pk trace rho v k log rho v k minus pk log pk. I think I got this right. So this is the bit that will depend on the fact that your algebra was not maximal, on the fact that your density matrix had to be block diagonal, and in a path integral, what's going to happen is that you really want to define these guys first. So you want to define them sector by sector. So you should really, you know, maybe choose k here. So you should really choose that some, you know, region here of your interval v where your edge modes live. As I said, edge modes is a misnomer. Your things can live here as well, but whatever. We might be stuck with it now. And the point is, if you want to get this individual rho v, k, then you will do a path integral with this as a boundary here. And then, if you want to compute this entire thing, then you'll have to do many path integrals, each with a different choice of the boundary condition. They're all boundary conditions of the same type. In this example here, they're Dirichlet conditions because I'm just specifying the eigenvalue of xv. So I'm fixing the value of the field on the edge. But the point is that I have to sum over both xv equals plus 1 and minus 1. So the choice of algebra fixes a type of boundary condition, but it doesn't fix a particular value of the boundary condition. That's fixed by your state. You know, your state will spit out once you do this. This density matrix will have some values of pk that tell you what's the relative weight of boundary conditions with x equals plus 1 and x equals minus 1. And so you need to be careful about doing this. So, you know, when you do a path integral, you may be tempted to just say, okay, I will set my fields to vanish. I will choose Dirichlet conditions such that my fields are somehow zero. Let's say if it's a compact scalar at the boundary. But doing so will only give you this. Will only give you, you know, one of these guys here. You will miss a lot of these guys here, and these are actually important for getting the right. Getting the right topological entanglement entropy, let's say. If you do this for a lattice gauge theory, then keeping track of these p log p terms is actually important because that they will actually in a topological lattice gauge theory, you will actually get all the entropy coming just from these guys because there are no other local correlations to deal with. So that's something to keep in mind. That's a technical point. And the only other comment that I want to make before, you know, just taking questions, is that there is a third subtlety here, which has to do with non-abelian fields. So when we have non-abelian gauge fields, then everything I said goes through. Except we have to worry about this annoying fact that I will say it like this first. So you will get something that we can call log dim r. So basically what happens is that if your state involves some electric field lines that go like this in some representation R of the gauge group, and they go through the boundary like this. What happens in the gauge theory is that if you choose the maximal algebra, you always get a center. So you always get, and this is usually called an electric center. It's essentially due to the fact that the operator here, the electric operator here, that is, by the Gauss law, equal to the operator here, and so it has to commute with everything else. So in a gauge theory, what happens is you always, the maximal algebra, if you have all of these operators available, you always get a center, you always get edge modes. And in a non-abelian case, the electric flux is actually labeled by the representation of the gauge group. And that means that in the Hilbert space that this operator ends up acting on is not one-dimensional. It has a dimension which is essentially the dimension of the representation. You know, different values of the flux, different representations that label the flux, act on Hilbert spaces of different size here. And so once you look at what reduced density matrix you get, you actually get that you are in a maximally mixed state of the remaining color index that's sort of dangling here. That's like saying that there is a matter field, matter edge mode in the representation R living here. So because you're in a maximally mixed state, what ends up happening is that your rho v has looks like it has the identity operator here, and it gives you this extra contribution to the entropy. And so you can choose, you can now choose to define an entropy where you have not done this, so this is another choice that you can make. So there are generically three different contributions to the entropy. One coming from each of the sectors separately, one type coming from each sector separately, one coming solely from the edge modes, and one coming from any non-abelian edge modes you have. And this is it. And it turns out that all three are actually important if you want to reproduce known results. For instance, if you want to reproduce the 1/2 log k topological entanglement entropy of Chern-Simons theory, you actually need this stuff. Because the way we normally think about Chern-Simons theory is that we sort of canonically quantize, and we actually do have edge modes on the edge of the entangling region, etc. And we need these modes to have this non-trivial Hilbert space size in order to extract out the topological entanglement entropy. So bottom line is that you can choose, and some path integrals will give you pieces of this. By the way, doing this in the path integral amounts to sort of gauge fixing away all the degrees of freedom at the very edge of your entangling region. So you have a choice whether to treat them as physical or not, and you can choose to gauge fix them away in your path integral, and you will get rid of this contribution. And equally, like, you will only get this contribution if you do the path integral taking into account all possible boundary conditions of the same class. That's the end of the story that I wanted to say. I just wanted to emphasize that all of these choices give us different answers, and different path integral prescriptions can give us different, can lend us on different entropies like that. In a CFT, we have things like conformal boundary conditions, different ones, and choosing different conformal boundary conditions will land us on different choices there. Very little is known about this, but something is, and I can tell you more about this later. So basically, every time you say that you have a method for describing entanglement entropy, you will land on, you will have made some of these choices, and will have landed on one of these numbers here. And when you compare them, you need to make sure you're comparing the same things. So that's the end of my spiel. And I'm here for another 10 days, so I'm open to questions the entire period. Thanks. I'll take questions later. Yeah.
The last sign should be plus, right?
That is probably true, yes. That's true, yeah, sorry. Well, if this is the only minus sign I got wrong, then I... No, but, okay, yes, that's right. Oh, by the way, I should also say that one thing that's obvious, that's not obvious, is what do all of these choices do in holography? like Ryuta Kenagi calculates something. We have very good reason to think that it calculates the full thing because it gets the right conformal anomalies. And I have arguments for why, you know, this is the only thing that will calculate the right conformal anomaly. But in theory, like all of these choices have some duals in the bulk, and we have no idea what they are. So I wanted to end with that. I'm going to talk fast. Thanks for to the organizers for asking me to do this, and thanks, George, for a very careful and rigorous introduction to all this stuff. I want to talk about open questions, I'm going to have to throw away some of this nice rigorous discussion. But I'd like to maybe focus on sort of how much. Well, okay. At each step, probably something will have to be modified. So I sort of took inspiration from this nice discussion that Gary and okay. So I'll start by erasing step zero. So for quantum gravity, we obviously can't do step zero.
Is it obvious?
Okay. Well, maybe we can. Okay. So I took some inspiration from this nice discussion that Gary and Douglas led, where they sort of listed some open questions, and I'm going to do a similar kind of thing, and list some, yeah, thanks. And then just sort of list some open questions, and maybe the audience can propose some, and then I'll talk about one or two. Okay. So maybe one, which is a kind of, okay. I'm going to start from the most, maybe the biggest, most ambitious ones, and then we'll work our way down to something maybe we can solve. Okay, so the first thing I want to raise is to what extent can we understand entanglement entropy and quantum gravity? So George had this very nice formula for non-abelian gauge theories which I'll just write again. It has, if you like, you have some probability distribution P sub k over super selection sectors, and some density matrices rho, and there's going to be, the first term is an expectation value of the von Neumann entropy of these rho k's. There's some fluctuations over the different super selection sectors, and then there was this term, which is the expectation value of their dimension. So one possible idea is that gravity, quantum gravity, can be thought of as it's a gauge theory in the sense that it has a huge gauge symmetry of diffeomorphisms, and perhaps we can understand it in a framework like this, where now we have can think about having sort of different representations, and what we find is that there's some term which so I want to focus on this last term, this sort of I think George called it the annoying term, which is actually kind of interesting because it's local and it has a form of an expectation value. So it's been noticed by some people that perhaps there's some connection between this object and the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and in some simple models, one can show that this term plays a role similar to this. Okay, so I want to kind of break. Okay, so that leads to some sequence of questions. So first, maybe first of all, the question of how to specify a region. So do we want to fix some kind of boundary conditions, or do we want to try to do in some diff-invariant way, say which region we're talking about, or do we have to do something even more general than that?
sort of what are the edge bones? What are the degrees of freedom which are being, which we imagine are being sort of localized to this region that you need in order to sort of glue different regions together? And is there anything like this? Can we understand sort of what are the leftover gauge, the sort of leftover symmetries of this region whose representations we're counting? Okay. And I want to mention, okay, so this is okay, so I started with the sort of biggest picture I could, but there are some sort of special cases that we might think about that are sort of more tractable. So maybe one of them is one can ask these questions perturbatively. So even if quantum gravity non-perturbatively can't be put in a framework like this, we might hope that we can at least treat perturbative gravity as an ordinary quantum field theory.
But since we have made contact with the first part, are you implicitly assuming that we have already taken some finite Hilbert space approximation of this that we have discussed?
Oh, yeah. Very, very good. So I think for gravity, probably one wants to do something a little bit different in the sense that, we could think about how to apply George's recipe. So step one, or step zero is quantize gravity and have a Hilbert space. Then step one is then to choose some local algebra. So even there, there's an issue. So even perturbatively, one has to choose some kind of dressing or of operator. So you don't expect to have something like a local algebra associated to a region in that case. So what I think that's a question, and I think people should feel free to come up with their own answer, to suggest answers to this. What I would maybe like to advocate is that we first try to think about these questions at the level of a classical theory and think about, so one possible thing to do if you don't have a quantum theory to start with is to start with a classical theory and try to find some analogy of these structures. So for example, you can try to write, if you did this for Yang-Mills, you could write down, say, classical Yang-Mills theory on a lattice and try to construct local regions and see how they glue how their phase spaces glue together. And one can ask many of the analogous questions, and then from that structure you can build a quantum theory.
Even in the classical case, you are imagining some discretization.
So I think once you have a classical phase space, discretization becomes a question that you can ask of it. Right. So it has to do with whether the phase space is compact, whether certain submanifolds of the phase space are compact, whether things are, if the whole thing is compact, then you should have a finite dimensional Hilbert space upon a quantization.
Were you worried that in gravity different regions are not linear independent could be the case, like this island thing, kind of a region and the sub-region of the gravity, already you thought if they are disjoint, but if they are
Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. I think this is sort of related to this question A, sub question A. So indeed, you might have thought that in an ordinary quantum field theory, you can specify the geometry of some region. You have some fixed background, specifies the geometry of some region, and you've also fixed its topology. In quantum gravity, You might have thought that you could at least, say, fix the topology of the region that you're talking about. You wouldn't expect it to be able to fix its geometry. We know that to be fluctuating. I think what this discussion of islands has shown us is that probably fixing its topology is also not is not the right thing to do. So one guess you might have made, say based on RT, you might have thought a nice gauge invariant way of specifying a region is to say fix something asymptotically, and then to consider some extremal surface, you know, the region bounded by an extremal surface. And you might try to quantize with those boundary conditions just imposed from the start. I think what this Engelhardt wall prescription or this island, you know, and this island discussion tells us that no, that's really not what you should do, because in fact, when you do these holographic calculations, what you find is that you should also that you should be looking at these quantum extremal surfaces, which may not be anywhere near extremal surfaces. So you might have initially thought, okay, well, I'm always close to some extremal surface, so maybe I just need to correct this boundary condition by a small amount, but really, the whole topology changes.
I mean, the fact that you should use a quantum extremal surface, well, that's because you're trying to compute a certain thing for which that's the relevant surface. But that doesn't mean to me that you couldn't interestingly define a region by an extremal surface and compute an
Yeah, that's true, but it seems like you would be calculating something different than what you're calculating by these.
Yeah.
What you're calculating is something different than than the entanglement entropy of the dual CFT.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, good. So those are. No, that's true. You can make different choices and get different results. Okay. Maybe one thing that we should consider is that actually there's no, one actually doesn't want to impose any boundary condition, that actually one should in some sense just allow for all possible boundaries, but weighted in some way. So these seem to be distinct options. Good. And one of the nice things about perturbative gravity, say one just wanted to talk about, one thing that I think may be interesting, which is still, as far as I, is still unknown, is whether one can calculate entanglement for perturbative gravitons, and have a, and what are the sort of relevant edge modes for that calculation. What's nice about this case is that the issue of specifying a region is in some sense a higher order effect. That's something you don't need to worry about in this calculation.
A comment going beyond the perturbative level, you know, since we don't really know how to think about quantum geometry or whether, you know, really the geometry is the exactly right concept in the quantum theory, maybe a more primitive question is how to specify a subsystem. And it may or may not correspond to something we think of as, you know, a region of space-time, ultimately. That's a more fundamental question in quantum gravity.
Yeah, that's right. So even in a field theory, there's a huge range of things that you could call a subsystem. So George focused on these algebras that you think of as associated to some region, but of course you mentioned you could think of some region in momentum space or some combination, and that's a much more general concept. I wanted to sort of think of these things as being localized in some sense in space, but it may be that that's not. It may be that that's just not possible at all. Okay. Then we're really in trouble, I think. But it's a possibility.
Are we actually guaranteed any sort of separation in principle? I mean, it might not be that any.
Well, you mean, are there subsystems?
Subsystems.
That's a very good question. Right? How do we think about that at a more fundamental level? It's when we can study in these approximations, and you discover things just you know, by following your nose, like, for example, the fact that you don't have commuting algebras associated with space-like separated regions, or at least generically, the algebras don't commute. So that's a failure of the usual kind of thing in field theory. And then, you know, there's the more general question of what actually is the correct structure of gravity.
But the lesson of the previous talk is we can talk about entanglement without speaking of subsystems at all.
Well, I think
the problem is the subalgebras in this case, that you don't have the, or at least the subalgebras have a different structure.
So I think actually, I think I would have said it the other way around, that actually one can, I think that's a, at least a certain notion of subsystem may be a more general, more general than a notion of subalgebra, actually. In the sense that in, so maybe I can come to another class of special cases, which are say 2D and 3D gravity, where one has a TQFT, one can write down a TQFT description. And there you can consider a region which wouldn't have anything that you would call an algebra of observables localized in some region. So say take Trin-Simons theory on a disk or something like this. If all your loops are contractible, then you don't have non-trivial operators there. And yet, people still talk about entanglement there, and so you can ask what's the notion of subsystem that you're talking about there. And what seems to be the answer is that you have something like a Hilbert space of states associated to a disk, but the operators that act on that Hilbert space are not what you would call the sort of local gauge invariant operators of the bulk. They're all attached to the boundary. They're, in some sense, they just all live at the boundary, and they're these edge modes. So there's a sort of so there's a sort of alternative to this algebraic point of view where you can think about Hilbert spaces without, which don't have local operators. And maybe this is an analogy to gravity, where you also don't have, you know, where everything has to be dressed to the boundary in some sense.
Sorry, but in that case, you can think of local operators which just all happen to have expectation one. So, and you can multiply them, and the expectations just multiply. Like there's factorization. Like this object, like e to the I Wilson loop, is still an object whose expectation is one.
Okay.
Because there's no magnetic flux in the ground state.
Okay.
And then you can just think that there's a lot of very trivial, there's a lot of operators with very trivial expectation values, but non-zero.
I see.
So it's possible, at least there, to rephrase it. So, of course, for quantum gravity, it's unclear whether that's a useful way to think about it.
So you're saying I can think of these operators, which I would have called trivial, as living in some Hilbert space in a sort of take that the fact that they're trivial and move it in some sense from a kinematical fact into the expectation.
Yeah. Because you can get in a lattice gauge theory, you can get this topological phase by tuning the coupling to zero. But if you now start cranking up the coupling, the Yang-Mills coupling to be larger, eventually we'll get flux excitations. So some of these fluxes will stop being trivial.
Yeah, good. So I think
then you will start getting, you know, your blue balls and things.
So I think what you're saying may just be an algebraic version of what I'm saying. You would construct some. So the way I would think of it is you have some Hilbert space, say, where everything kind of has to be dressed to the boundary. And what you're saying is, well, I can kind of embed that into some other, into some larger Hilbert space, which would have local degrees of freedom. And it just so happens I'm only considering such states where none of those local degrees of freedom are excited.
Right. The big question is, can gravity be embedded like that?
Good.
Just a comment. So the algebraic structure, as we were just discussing, doesn't necessarily look like it's the right way to get at the subsystems. But plausibly, there is a structure which is associated, you know, which is a certain kind of structure on the Hilbert space, which involves, you know, sort of a type of nesting between Hilbert spaces, which I think is a little bit similar to what was just being said. where you can have, say, Hilbert space that corresponds to, or sub-Hilbert space that corresponds to states that, you know, that are excitations, in a sense, in some region, and that's embedded into the bigger Hilbert space.
This is supposed to be exactly approximate.
Well, one can start to see this structure pretty clearly in the perturbative theory, but, you know, going beyond to the full non-perturbative theory, open question.
Yeah, no, that's a good, I mean, in this discussion yesterday that Henry and Don were leading, or this, one of the lessons from that appeared to be that non-perturbative diffeomorphism invariance is just a much stronger constraint than perturbative diffeomorphism invariance. That there's, it seems to be that, so even, and perturbative diffeomorphism invariance, you know, even if you can solve that, it seems like there may be some operators that you naively would have thought were completely different, and yet they're the same.
I have a question about the basic question. Like, so you're thinking about trying to define the entropy of some region in the bulk, right?
Yes.
Are we imagining that that will involve an area term, or?
That's what I'm imagining. Yes.
Feels like the special case alpha, like there should at least, what that guarantees you is it feels like it should guarantee you that there should be a good notion that we couple like the entropy of bond fields and gravitons in some region.
That's right. That would be like the, yeah, the GH bar to the zero term, the sort of, yeah. Right,
but, well, why are we supposed to expect an area piece?
Oh, you're saying, I see what you're saying. Why should we expect? Well, good. So the perturbative things give you an area piece, but in some sense it's a too small.
Like
so
a cutoff.
Exactly. It's some UV cutoff thing.
By area piece?
No. I think the way what we should think about is the scaling with Newton's constant is the right way to think about it. So this is sort of a G to the zero term. So, yeah, you might ask, why would you expect this to give you a 1 over G type of term?
Like, is there obviously a thing that's well-defined enough that, well, I don't know what the argument is for expecting a 1 over G term that makes sense for that computation?
Good. One thing I can say concerns the... So there's an old argument... due to Lenny Susskind, at least in string theory, that you should have something. If you think about what this contact interaction would be for a string world sheet, what it is it's a sum of diagrams that intersect with the entangling surface. And there you have a sphere diagram where the thing that you have there that's not in the perturbative field theory description is this sphere diagram, which has, because it's G to zero, scales like 1 over G. So another thing that one can think about is you can look at large N gauge theories. So maybe I can briefly talk about that. But what you find is that if you take, at least with certain large N gauge theories, if you take a, you can ask how the different terms scale with N, and the N squared scaling term is like the 1 over G term, and you find that this is the unique term that has an N squared type of scaling.
But does that have an obvious consequence for computations of entropy in some region of the bulk? That feels like an entropy of a boundary region.
No, that's right. So in the model that you do is this, it's this, or the model that I understand, which is this two-dimensional Yang-Mills model, really what happens is the strings actually are, in a sense, in the bulk. There's kind of no distinction between the two. So you have an order. So really it is a bulk entanglement entropy in that sense.
Okay, but sorry. Are you maybe you're imagining that like
the UV divergent part. And so in field theory, we have some entropy, and there's some UV divergent area part. Mm-hmm. Imagining that in the quantum gravity theory, that UV divergence is regulated, but that, like, it's not very interesting because it's the same for all states or something like it.
Well, so in a gravity theory, what I would expect to happen is the following, that you have some, if you just think about the sort of classical phase space of associated to some region, it has some symplectic structure, which is like the, you know, in which we'd use to calculate the phase space volume, and that thing naturally has a 1 over g in it. So the phase space volumes are sort of all naturally in calculated in Planck units. The reason you don't see it in the perturbation theory is because you normalize the perturbations in such a way that that those factors all get absorbed. But if you could actually, you know, if you could actually calculate a volume of this phase space, it would naturally have this kind of scaling to it. But yeah, this is very speculative. This is like the, you know, could you actually construct a phase space associated to some region, which was finite, and see its volume?
I was going to say this Jaffris paper by Jaffris and Kolchmeier, in which they discussed JT gravity.
Yeah, good.
Where they got an area term. So I don't know that paper very well, but they had an area term that they got from some kind of bulk description.
Yeah.
Where would you would say that that's like a log de Maar kind of term, or?
It comes about in a similar kind of way. So yeah, maybe I'll talk about that. So that was going to be one of my points. So I'll make a point to you. JT gravity and VF. So this is a nice example where you can understand things in a similar kind of way. So there's a. What's nice is that there's a description as just an ordinary gauge theory, which is an SL2RBF theory. Now, and you can do a similar kind of thing where you're considering an entanglement entropy that you can think of as like, so here's your ADS2 manifold, sort of between one side and the other, and you can think of it as being cut somewhere in the bulk. And here you can express this in the BF language. It's naturally, you know, you can write down some class of representations of SL2R, which are labeled by some parameter S. And then the whole bulk calculation winds up being basically to figure out what's the appropriate measure on these states S. So in the compact case, you'd have some representations R, say, and then they would be weight. There'd be some when summing over these representations, your measure would include some factor of dim R. Hmm. So, in this case, what you find is that there's some measure associated to S. Okay. If you write down the sort of naive BF measure, so it's called a Poincaré measure, and it's basically this, but generalized. It's the natural generalization of this to the continuum. What you find is some measure that grows linearly with S, something like S tan S. Their factors of pi. So, okay. So I think this was pointed out in a paper by Jennifer Lin.
Can I ask you? What?
Maybe I'll just get to the punchline, and then you can ask the question. Jaffris and Kolchmeier did. As I understand it, is to point out that this isn't really the right this isn't really the right boundary condition for gravity. So what you would expect from the point of view of a gravitational theory, or if you wanted to reproduce the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, you need this to be growing exponentially with this, and this doesn't. Okay. And what they found is that you had to insert some defect into the bulk from the BF point of view looks like a defect that's basically imposing that when you cut out some tiny disk around here and fill it in, that you fill it in with something that has the topology of the disk. And they find instead something that goes, I think this gets replaced with a cinch, which grows exponentially. And so that you can see that you get the bends you're talking about.
I just wanted to ask you about this relationship between the BF theory and JT gravity. So what is the statement about how gauge transformations are related to diffeomorphisms?
It's almost exactly the same as the 3D transimens case.
You have to use equations of motions to realize? In transimens, you have to go on show.
I believe that's the case here too. Yeah, you have to use flatness, I think.
And is that not a problem at some level or not? I worry that I'm using on-shell conditions and realizing the symmetries or defining
that doesn't
the Hilbert space or whatever. Like,
as far as I can tell, that isn't the issue. The issue is really more about which configurations you include in these two different, in these theories. So there's some discussion about these states of zero metric. So the BF theory includes much more than the gravity theory, and that's why I think it's ultimately why they had to impose this condition. So this sort of unit winding condition that you fill in with a disk. Because if you just did the naive BF thing, what that's doing is that's summing over all possible connections, many of which don't have any description as a gravitational configuration.
So that should seem to suppress the measure rather than enhance it, like the way you just said it. Why is it enhancing the measure?
Good.
Stands to a cinch.
Good question. Good. Naively, you're summing over less states, so you should have less entropy in some sense.
That's just a vague.
Yeah. I don't know precisely in this case. There's an analogous case where you do just 2D GR. And there, what happens is the topological restriction that you put, when you restrict the field configurations, you actually are restricting a Lagrange multiplier, and you're freeing degrees of freedom. So I think it may be, so I'm not sure if that's exactly what's happening in this case, but I suspect that really what's happening is that you're somehow liberating degrees of freedom by putting some constraint. This is just like, there's this picture of, four-dimensional gravity as a constrained BF theory. So you start with some, theory with no degrees of freedom, and you put a constraint on it, you might think you have less than no degrees of freedom, but no, you have many degrees of freedom.
So if I were thinking of JT, it's a low-energy approximation to SYK.
Yes.
Is this entanglement related to the entanglement between two boundary theories? How much teleportation are you doing from one side to the other side?
Yes, that's right. This is just you do the same calculation that you would do to calculate a thermal entropy in SYK, and you just take the limit, the sort of Schwarzian limit of that calculation, and that's what this is.
But that's still a notion of a boundary entropy, right? I think it's different from trying to define the bulk entropy. For example, you cannot get any area piece. You can only get the horizon piece. Right? If I want to just describe like the entropy of like some bulk region, bulk segment, where I get
that's a good question.
Like, delta field theory.
Yeah. So good. So it'd be interesting to understand better the bulk interpretation of this calculation. So I don't understand. I'm not entirely sure if one should think of this exactly what picture one should associate with it with this calculation. Whether one should think of the endpoint as being fixed at the extremal surface, or if in some sense you should think of this endpoint as being fluctuating and it just happens to prefer to be at the extremal surface. as a like a you do it to get the area of the extremal surface, you use some saddle point approximation of some integral. So that much isn't clear, but I think that would go some way to answering this question of how you specify a region. Maybe I should wrap up here. I had a few more questions that I was going to write down, but I deliberately started with the most interesting one, with the hope that people would interrupt and ask and motivate some discussion. So I think, okay, well, it's 1.5 questions, but if there are more questions from the audience, then I'll take those, and otherwise maybe let's wrap up there. Thanks.
What do you consider to be the tractable?
Oh, yeah, okay. Good. Maybe I'll just write a bunch of questions, and then I'll... these are in order of most to least, or least to most tractable, I think. So one of them, we could ask what's entanglement in string theory. And actually, that's something that we should talk about. I wanted to talk a little bit about, some of these came up at large n, just to understand how the different sort of pieces of the entanglement scale. I wanted to ask about dualities, so how does entanglement entropy behave, say, under electromagnetic duality and things like that, maybe even holographic duality. Okay, we'll talk a bit about what are the appropriate boundary conditions of CFT, and, what?
Six.
Oh, yeah, because I'm off by one, because I added a two. Okay.
Six.
Seven. And then, actually, there are some interesting open questions, even in the context of TQFT, of just sort of what are the possible boundary conditions. And there, I think, potentially, you could even have a complete classification of what are all possible, what are sort of all possibilities. So I'll be around for another 2.5 weeks or so. So ask me about all of these things.
Just ask a question about this Jeffers Kolschmeier result.
Yeah.
Did they derive the measure, including like the normalization of it, and get? I think you said it gives the right entropy or something. But there's a specific numerical factor that is the right.
Yeah, that's right. They are able to get like the analog of A over 4G, which is like dilaton value at the extremum. There is a question of the sort of overall normalization of the. There are some like because you're doing BF on a non-compact group, there are factors of like that are like the volume of a gauge group that are sort of divergences that have to be. Gotten rid of in an appropriate way, but you really do get the 1/4 4G from this. So it's sort of it seems like a very hopeful, it's a very special case, but the fact that you're able to understand this from a point of view that's basically a bulk gravity calculation, I think, is very heartening, right?
I think I understand this computation as computing the graviton correction to the entanglement entropy, because the S0 you just put in by hand from the from the action, and this is analogous to doing step alpha, I think.
Oh, I see.
At least the way I understand it, maybe I'm wrong, but then you're computing the entanglement entropy of the gravitons, where the gravitons live at the boundaries, and you're just computing that norm properly.
Oh, I see.
It's not realizing the states in the Hilbert space of the Schwarzian theory.
That's a good point.
But still, you get some correction that's like the one loop correction coming from the expectation value of the area as modified by the gravitons?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so you get
those kinds of terms, yeah.
Yeah, I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everything that has to do with the quantum mechanics of the gravitons, so they manage to do that. So we like the perturbative, the whole perturbative result of the correction.
As a new action piece.
I see.
plus.
Yeah. Usually we will see perturbative like the order went, which is a lot of
bit.
Yeah,
yeah,
this calculation, they come together.
I see. So you're saying you need to, yeah, okay. So you, if you wanted a really a bulk interpretation of that, then you'd need something like microstates or something beyond what you see in your ordinary, just in this description.
I'm not getting a manifest. I mean, part of the discussion here in your point one, I mean, if we could do point one, we would get a description of the microstates. Right?
Yeah.
We could actually start with gravity and do one.
No, I think that's right.
Here we're not getting the microstates, so it's, I think it's morally equivalent to alpha.
But it is, but it's slightly more than that, right? Because there's a contribution that's going like 1 over g newton. So I would have thought that the graviton contribution would be order g newton to the 0, and these are like we get this phi h piece, right? The dilaton at the horizon, you get that.
The
maybe
part
a
of the entropy.
Mistake.
Part that goes linearly with t. I would have thought that that also has maybe a microstate interpretation. This term goes as one of the Newton, as Rugel was mentioning.
I think this computation is equivalent to the computation that Douglas and Ted Whitten did of computing this partition function. It's just saying how you get that this partition function from the expectation. I mean, how you get it from the quantum mechanics of a tool. Not manifestly the trace, it's the expectation value some operator. Yeah. It's like Tom was saying.
Yes.
And my question is, I guess, really about both talks and not specifically about gravity. So when you write the entropy as the sum of these three terms.
Yes.
Well, I think I understand the first term is the amount of entanglement you can distill or use for teleportation in each sector, average over the sectors. And the second one is just the classical Shannon entropy of the decomposition in the sectors.
Yes.
And now, if I want to interpret the third one operationally, it's telling me about the number of ways in which the sectors can fuse, like in as I would want to quantify if I were computing topological entanglement.
I think that's a good way to characterize it, yes.
But now, in the case of JT, I guess I was kind of a little confused about how to relate what was being computed to decomposition and determinants and where it's really coming from.
Good. So there is a... So there's a bit of a challenge, which is that here implicitly, I was writing something for a compact group where the representations are discrete, and so you just have a sum, and then you can say, then you can in a clean way separate out the sort of probability term from a kind of from a piece that's coming from the measure, right? Like I can say, okay, this thing is coming from the measure because I have a measure that is like one on every one of these things that I can compare it to. In the continuum, it's less, the separation between these two terms is less clear. You just have a measure, and if you calculate the entropy, you're sort of calculating these two things together. In other words, if I were to relabel, so I might have thought, okay, I can think of this object as being like my Bekenstein-Hawking entropy type of term, say, and then the fluctuations in, you know, the entropy. For any given state, there'll be some values of S, and there's some continuous probability distribution. I could calculate some version, some continuous entropy of that distribution. But now, if I relabel my S interval, do a change of variables, I'll shift contributions between these two terms. So it's here just because there's a continuum, it's sort of less clear where I should interpret these things. Ultimately, what one I think would like to do is have you know, if you really sort of backed off from this low energy Schwarzian type description and really did the SYK thing, of course there'd be no continuum. You'd have really discrete things, and you'd be able to distinguish those two things. You'd be able to say, sort of, what's the term that's counting the different microstates?
Yeah.
The two things are different ways of computing the same thing.
This is a way of computing that thing in some limit. Yes, that's right. But when you take the limit, you sort of lose the ability to distinguish between these two terms.
But you keep the distilling part completely separate. You can't do anything to mess up to sort of extract more genuine structure of space time.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Could I, is there some description where I would sort of conflate these
break
terms, say?
I
think that would probably, so I don't know of an example where that happens, but I imagine that it could happen in some, it's a very natural thing to happen under say, like something like a renormalization group flow, where you might have said, okay, if I can measure all observables down to some lattice scale, I can extract this much entanglement. But now I zoom out a little bit, and I can no longer, operate on some block average spins or something.
Yes.
So then I would be able to. This would be smaller, but there are arguments that basically what happens is that entropy winds up flowing into some different terms. So when I sort of make my spins larger, now there's some sort of local, it just gets reabsorbed into kind of a local counter term. It shows up in some different, it can show up, so in some cases it can show up as the expectation value of some local operator, or it can show up as just some bare counter term, which is just some number. So it can, the entropy can kind of flow between these different terms under RG.
More questions?
All right, let's thank you all again.